This is On The Tee Golf New Zealand Podcast, hosted by Tom Hyde and Brendan Telfer. Proudly presented by Podcasts New Zealand and Gorilla Voice Media.
Well, hello again and welcome to On The Tee, our golfing podcast. I'm Brendan Telfer, and today our guest is Greg Turner, joining us to talk about the art, or the profession, I guess, would be more the appropriate term, of golf course design. How do you design a golf course? Well, this is one of the main, in fact, probably the leading golf focus for Greg Turner these days, now that his professional touring days are finished. We're coming to, of course, in association with JK's World of Golf out there at Auckland Airport, open 24/7, and always there for you, always there for you when your flight is delayed. And the Akarana Golf Club, now one of the top courses in Auckland, situated in Dominion Road, just 10 minutes from the airport and 15 minutes from the city, and currently offering some very, very good corporate membership deals. Okay, so how do you go about designing a golf course? And how do you become a golf course architect? Well, for many years, of course, most of the superstars of golf tried their hand at golf course design. You think of Jack Nicklaus, Greg Norman, Colin Montgomery, Nick Faldo, even our own Bob Charles, I think, has tried his hand at some golf course design, and Gary Player, at the ripe old age of 80, still actively involved in golf course design in many different parts of the world. So with me today, as I said, is our guest, Greg Turner. Greg, thank you very much indeed for your time. Tell us firstly about your journey from a touring professional to a golf course designer.
A bit like my golf game, long and circuitous, Brendan. I got interested in golf course design back in the early 90s. I used to travel a lot with an Australian guy, Mike Clayton, who's likewise gone into the design side of business. And we used to room together. We swapped stories about golf courses. We got interested at the same time. We read a book by a very young designer named Tom Doak, whose main claim to fame in those days was writing about the game rather than actually designing. And what he said in his confidential guide kind of made a lot of sense to me, and that sort of sparked an interest that we then went off and started reading kind of a lot of the tomes. I guess that it's interesting when you start studying design, you realize that there are probably 8 or 10 books that all of the designers talk about and relate to. So I kind of used that simplistic approach. I thought if you want to get a degree in something, you go to university, basically they get you to read a lot of what the experts have said in the field, and then they ask you questions about it, and if you answer enough of them right, you get a degree. And so I sort of adopted that philosophy. I just consumed all I could from reading those books, and then what that enabled, I guess, it put me in a position where all of a sudden I started looking at golf courses through a slightly different lens. When you're a player, you look at the course through a pretty narrow lens, that sort of as it affects your own performance and your own game. When you're thinking about the design side of things, obviously you have to look at it through the lens of a wide variety of playing skills and playing levels. And so I sort of started doing that, and Clates and I started when we had a week off or we had a few days off, we'd go and visit some of the great courses that, many of which were not part of the tour. And it sort of evolved from there.
I imagine, Greg, one of the great golf course designers whose work you would have read was Alistair McKenzie. I think he was an Englishman, but associated, of course, mainly, I suppose, through his work at St Andrews. He says in this wonderful book, which I've read many times, and I'm going to read it again soon because I picked it up ahead of this interview here, and it just reminded me of what a wonderful read it is. He says, I quote from the book here, "A good architect should have made a study of agricultural chemistry, botany, geology, map reading, surveying, and being able to interpret aerial photographs. How many of those boxes can you tick?"
Well, not a lot, but I think fortunately from the times of Dr. McKenzie, who incidentally is one of my heroes as well, technology's moved on a little bit to make things a little bit easier in those realms. You don't quite need to have the quite that variety of skill sets, but certainly a broader range of understanding. You know, you've got to learn to read contour maps. For certain, that makes life easier, and you've got to get out and get your hands dirty and sort of understand the construction side of things as well, in terms of what works and what doesn't, and how form relates to function. And you know, I guess you can do that either by studying those skills at university or in that sort of sense, or you can do it in the practical sense on the ground. And I was still playing a lot at the time as I got interested. So it was more on the practical side of things. I tried to build that skill set, if you like.
Is it fair to say that most architects fall into one or two or three different schools? The old traditional architectural style, where you basically just take the land as it is and put 18 flagsticks around, or perhaps the more modern American approach of bringing in lots of soil and creating lakes and building golf courses from scratch. What school do you fall into?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a few more greys in that. Certainly the minimalist, I mean, we'd all like to be minimalists, right? To be able to move as little as possible. And certainly back in the Golden Age, in Mackenzie's time, there wasn't the ability to be able to move much. Also, though, as it happened, I think back then, a lot of the land that was set aside for golf was the sort of land that's actually ideal for golf, those marginal strips where the need to create form, well, there wasn't a need to create form because it already existed. And I think, yeah, the way the game evolved, it's impossible to me to not sort of understand that, you know, I think the game evolved in the way it did very much because of the environments that it evolved in. You know, I think if it evolved on agricultural land, we'd probably be playing something more akin to sort of 60-acre croquet than we would golf. That would have been the way the game evolved, because that's the sort of the nature of the terrain that was available. Because the back in the day there was the only place you were allowed to put golf was really in those marginal strips. It was good agricultural land. It was set aside for agriculture. Then those designers could afford to be a little bit more minimalist. Nothing more pleasing than to get a piece of land where you don't have to do much. But quite often these days, you know, the strips of or the land that's available for golf is not perfect. So therefore, there is a need to be a bit more creative.
I want to talk to you about two golf courses here in the Auckland area, which to me, I suppose, epitomise maybe the different ends of the golf architecture spectrum. Titirangi, where Mackenzie had a big say back in 1929 when he was on his way to Melbourne to design Royal Melbourne, and he did a lot of sketchings and drawings that formed the basis of Titirangi as it is today. And then there's Gulf Harbour, designed by Robert Trent Jones, or Robert Trent Jones Jr., I think, which was very much, I suppose, epitomising the modern face of a modern golf course. So what do you make of those two? And where do you sit between those two?
Well, look, I mean, I've got a preference, a significant preference for Titirangi over the two. Look, it's hard to know. I mean, Gulf Harbour's a difficult piece of land. I think you'll probably find the rise and fall around Gulf Harbour's significantly more than it is at Titirangi, albeit that Titirangi's far from flat. Trent Jones Jr. has never been, frankly, he represents a style of architecture that I've never particularly liked. He tends, from what I've seen of his courses, when he gets on a piece of land that's quite hilly like that, he tends to put the tees and the greens on the high spots and then play down through the valley. So you end up with a lot of tee shots where you're hitting downhill, good vision off the tee, and then quite often hitting uphill to the top half of a flagstick. So, I mean, that's not a way to route a golf course that I think is particularly attractive. So while those you might say they're at different ends of the spectrum, this I think, you know, Robert Trent Jones Jr. and Alistair Mackenzie probably had quite a different attitude towards how the game should
be. But I mean, Trent must have something going for him, doesn't he? Because he's building golf courses and has been all around the world. So there's clearly a demand for that type of modern golf courses, and they're wherever the game's played.
Yeah, one of God's own private mysteries, that one. I think 380-something golf courses around the world now, and I think he has the distinction of not having a single one in the top 100, which is quite some effort. It's too late. I don't want to diss Trent Jones Jr., but But is his
ideas very much an American approach to modern golf course design? I mean, if you're living in Kansas City or somewhere in the Midwest and you're pining to play a links course, you can't. And so I remember Peter Thompson telling me this once when I was doing a television commentary with him, having a discussion after the day's play, that too many Americans want links courses in places like Kansas City, and so they hire these golf course designers to try and reproduce St. Andrews in Kansas City.
Well, there's, funnily enough, there are some big sand belts through America where they've done that pretty successfully, and guys like Cor Crenshaw Bill Cor and Ben Crenshaw and Tom Doak especially and Gil Hance have had real success doing that because of the nature of the subgrade and the soils rather than because they're right on the edge of the ocean. I think that if we, you know, the genre you're describing perhaps at Gulf Harbour is more a genre of that sort of 60s and 70s period. America, that was when golf courses or golf course design businesses became real sort of empires, if you like, really big businesses. And to be building multiple courses at the same time in various places around the world, you kind of have to have a, one would think, a bit more of an industrial attitude towards it. So, you know, I would say a lot of the nuance, a lot of the stuff that makes golf really interesting is you can only do with your boots on the ground. And by, you know, it's the sum of all of the little things that make a difference. And during those 60s and 70s especially, there were a lot of golf courses built where a single designer or a design company were building multiple courses at the same time in different locations. And as a consequence, you got sort of a bit of an industrial style of golf. And that, to me, is more, it's more of a case of its time rather than you know, a specific, I guess, genre, if you like.
Okay, to the actual art of designing a golf course, who do you design a golf course for? If someone comes to you today and says, Greg, here's an open check, I want a golf course, who do you make it for, the club members, the pros? It's an impossible task, I imagine, trying to please everyone who's going to belong to a golf club. So where do you settle on what sort of course you'll build?
Well, it's not impossible because plenty of designers have done it, you know, and a lot of the great courses that have been around for, you know, 100 years are great courses because they achieve that balance. And I think, you know, and ultimately the challenge, or one of the significant challenges for golf course designer is to have a sufficient challenge within the course to make it interesting for the elite player while not... While allowing still a playability for the average to the less skillful player. And, you know, that's hard. It's easy to make a course hard. It's easy to make it easy. It's more difficult to make it sufficiently challenging to capture the attention of the scratch player.
But it must be tough, though. I mean, you take yourself as a scratch golfer, obviously, as a professional, myself and Tom, regular sort of hackers playing with our 15, 16, 17, 18 handicaps. There are holes that I don't want to play because they're so difficult, which are a challenge to you. And so I get disillusioned because there's too many tough holes on my course. As I get older, I want the game to be a bit more enjoyable and a bit easier. So this is where the choice of a number of tees comes into it, is it?
Yeah, look, there's a number of things, and I'll generalise because it's hard to be specific. But in general, if it's narrow off the tee, then you're going to make it inordinately difficult for the less skilled. Yep. So one of the things that to me that characterises most of the great courses and most of the courses I like is that they're actually, there's plenty of room to play from the tee. The difficulty starts to arise as you get closer to the green, because for your 18 handicapper, quite often on a par four, for instance, it's actually their third shot they're attacking the green with, or they're coming from quite close to the green, whereas the elite player is playing from further back. So if, you know, if you can create a preferred side of the fairway, then the width of the fairway becomes kind of irrelevant to the good player. So the only way to create a preferred side of the fairway is to have the green offset to the center of the fairway. As soon as the middle of the fairway is the best place to play from, then you've kind of taken away any of the risk reward element that comes from trying to drive in close to the trouble. I mean, Royal Melbourne's a really good example. The first couple of times I played around Royal Melbourne, I can remember thinking, what's the big deal? These fairways are 50, 60 yards wide. And it was only after a couple of rounds that I just sort of worked out that if you headed out into the wide areas of those fairways, it was really hard to get the ball under the hole on the greens. Mm. And as soon as you're above the flag with those greens firm and fast, then you hit every fairway and you walk off with 75 or 76. So that's in a nutshell. That's it. But with length, obviously, with distance off the tees, you can make a difference. But also with offsetting the tees, I think that's something we don't. A lot of courses haven't done in New Zealand, especially. Whereas, if your tees are offset as you move forward up the tee zones, from black to blue to white to red to yellow, whatever your colours are, then you can be hitting more directly up the line of the fairway if they're offset. So not only are you creating more of a challenge from the back tee from a length perspective, if you've offset it to the fairway, you've also created a slightly more narrow driving area. You've done that for the elite player without having to have had to do it for the average player. Mm. So those are sort of some of the tricks of the trade, if you like, to try and get that balance right.
I notice a course up here that is very popular with golfers, club golfers in Auckland, is Murawai. It's available 365 days of the year because it's built on sand, so it doesn't have a problem because of the clay under the ground causing it to be very wet in winter. But I think one of the things that we, when I say golfers like me, club golfers or 15, 16 handicaps like, is the wide open fairways that you can stand on the tee and have a lash at many of the holes at Murawai, which you can't at a lot of other Parkland courses around Auckland.
One of the wonderful quotes that from McKenzie that I think explains that. I'm not sure if it's out of the spirit of St Andrews or not, but it was with regard to a course in Canada that he returned to after having been there sort of a decade before, and the captain took him around and said to him, like, to show some of the improvements they'd made. And he said, "Oh, you mean the changes?" And they got to this hole, and it was a dog leg left par four. And the captain happily said, "Look, and we've put this bunker in on way out on the right hand side." And McKenzie said, "What on earth that bunker for?" And he said, "Well, it's to penalise the badly sliced drive." He said, "You should feel sympathy for someone who slices that badly."
Yes, exactly.
Penalise it. And I think that's a really good notion to have. I think quite often when I'm talking to golfers, especially in New Zealand, I think there's a sense that, or people have this idea that hazards, and when I say hazards, that can be water, it can be bunkers, it can be long grass, it can be trees, that they're there to penalise the bad shot. I think the attitude you should take when you're trying to place hazards as a designer is they're there to make the hole more interesting. And those two are quite different. There's no point in adding insult to injury by putting a hazard, 120 metres off the tee and 40 metres to the right of the fairway. And nobody wants to go there. If they go there, it's a mistake. They're in a terrible place. They're way away from the green. You don't need to give them the double jeopardy of then being in a terrible place as well, or an unplayable lie. So if you think of the reason for hazards as being just to make the hole more interesting, then actually you're placing them in places that people want to go, not where people don't want to go. If you put it where I want to go, then I'm tempted to get as close to it as I can to leave myself the best net shot. Whereas, the 18, the 27 handicap is just happy to avoid it. And it's quite happy, I think if you sort of look at that as a philosophy, and if you apply that as a philosophy, then when you look around a lot of the courses, you can see, well, actually, there's no need for that bunker over there, or there's no need for there to be out of bounds down there, or there's no need for, long grass to be there.
Your thoughts on water on golf courses. I suspect you're probably of the McKenzie school and Peter Thompson school, who said to me that you should never build lakes. If there's not a natural stream or river or lake on the piece of land, there shouldn't be any water on the golf course. Are you of that school?
Look, in general, but not totally. I think golf, some water can add excitement in the right place.
For example, give me an example of where water can add to interest in a golf course.
Well, for instance, if we thought about Augusta, where a lot of us would be familiar with the course if we've never played it, the way the little brook at Ray's Creek runs in front of 13, winds its way down there is a wonderful little feature. You get a little babbling brook. You can always flick your ball out of it, and it's set at a nice diagonal angle.
Just dumping big lakes in the middle of a golf course, which happens around courses in New Zealand.
Yeah, then the question becomes, quite often at a course you need these days, especially and probably and even more likely into the future, you need a reservoir. You need to give yourself
your own water. Yeah.
So the question becomes, if you've got enough land for that reservoir to be away from golf, then you might want to do that. Quite often you haven't got enough land to do that. So therefore, you may as well try and integrate it into the design to make something more interesting. But if you're going to have water, then give people plenty of opportunity to avoid it, is what I would say. And certainly it's not, it's a feature to be used sparingly. But I wouldn't, I'm not of the school that you want to avoid it totally. I think sparingly is fine, but certainly when you do, give people the opportunity to avoid it.
Holes with blind shots. Most golfers hate them. Do you?
Oh, yeah, look, they're not my favourite. Again, sometimes they're unavoidable. I think one of Mackenzie's great designs was at La Perouse at New South Wales in Sydney, and there are two holes there that go across a big ridge that are pretty are the worst two holes on the course, in my opinion. But it's a ridge line that has to be navigated, and Mackenzie's decision was that sooner have two holes that were pretty ordinary and to allow 16 great holes than to spend four, five, six holes trying to navigate a particular feature and have a problem on all of those holes. So, if you're going to have a blind shot because of it's kind of necessary, then there are some certain rules I try and, I think it works. Things should never get narrower over into an area you're heading into. If you're heading over a hill that you can't see, then give people plenty of room to play, plenty of width. It ought to be a lot wider over there than narrower. And I think generally the holes that would be considered pretty decent holes, even though they have blind tee shots, are the ones where there's a lot of space over the top of the hill.
Do you like to make holes that from the tee play harder than they look?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the great, I think one of the aspects that a lot of the great designers have always been good at.
Camouflage.
Yeah, and if it's easier than it looks, then people get more of a sense of achievement. It's part of the fun is overcoming an obstacle, and that's where in Mackenzie's time he talked about being able to play every hole with a putter. And while that's not a bad overriding philosophy, sometimes the heroic carry is actually, gives you that real sense of enjoyment. Well, it doesn't need to be that far. But sometimes you get a hole and it might only be 100 metres from the members' tee to get over something. But again, it's that dread about getting to that spot where you've got that one mandatory carry, and will I take it on or will I lay it up? And then you get that sense of achievement when you do. So while I think there are broad concepts you want to try and obey, I don't think as soon as you start trying to operate to a formula, then I think you miss the point of golf a little bit. Part of the joy of it is that it isn't formulaic, that there are quirks. One of my favourite holes in the world, perhaps one of the most famous, is the road hole at St Andrews. Well, if I build a hole today where you hit blind over a hotel to a fairway sitting at 30 degree angle, over a stone wall, to then hit to a green that sits at 30 degrees the other way with a bunker in the front that you probably can't get out of, and a tarmacadam road with a rock wall on the other side, they would take you away in a straitjacket. They would say that's the daftest thing in the world to do. And yet, many, many players would say that is one of the most intriguing holes in golf. So how do you
manufacture it? Yeah. To golf courses generally in New Zealand, it surprises me a little when you consider this as a narrow coastal land where the majority of the 5 million people live up and down on the coastlines, that we don't have more links courses in New Zealand. I mean, do you know how many we've got? Would we have a dozen?
I think, it depends on where you draw the line and what is and isn't a links. Yeah. But there was a book out on links golf a few years ago that suggested that we actually have the second most number of links in the world outside of the British Isles. So we've kind of, but that, you know, that makes it 12 or 13 or something like that from memory. Look, I think we're a victim of our own good fortune in a funny way. When the game was evolving, the places you were allowed to play golf were those marginal strips where it was hard to grow grass. When they started building golf courses in New Zealand, if you like, when we first, which would have been sort of largely back at the, I guess, in the 30s and 40s, there were a few built before then, obviously, but then we actually had a surplus of farmland. So the attitude was, well, why would you try and grow golf where it's hard to grow grass? You know, let's build it where it's easy to grow grass. Unfortunately, that's actually not the best environment for golf. So we built a whole lot of courses on decent agricultural soils, which are actually not particularly useful for playing golf. And, you know, in Auckland's a classic example, where you've got a whole, the far and away the majority of courses are built on clay. Now, you know, in Auckland there wasn't really any choice. But what that's like.
Winter and summer.
Either concrete or mud. So we were a bit unfortunate. There's some good golf around the coast. The other thing that's interesting, and when you go to our major cities, what was regarded as the premier areas to live were not the sort of seaside areas. You know, I think Dunedin out at St Clair and St Kilda was not the lawyers and the accountants and the power brokers all lived up on the hill at Maori Hill. And I think you'd probably find that, certainly in Christchurch, it was out at, Merivale and out through there. It wasn't down on the beach. So again, the courses, the sort of the better clubs, if you like, the ones with a few more resources, were built close to the areas where the people with more resources lived, which again wasn't necessarily the best land for golf. So it's just it's kind of a quirk, I think.
You've been involved in working with a lot of golf courses in New Zealand, redesigning them, improving them, changing them. Tell me about Areti Sands, which is a unique golf course, isn't it? Right down at the very bottom of the South Island, somewhere near Bluff, I think, from memory. I think from occasions that I've played it, you can see Stewart Island even on a cloudy day. But it seems to have gone into, some sort of hibernation. Are you still working on it? Is it still alive? Is it still open?
Yeah, no, look, it's one of my great disappointments, Areti Sands. It's a terrific golf course, or was a terrific golf course. It's been closed now for a couple of years, maybe more. Southland went through a time, and I'm not sure it is right now, but certainly then where the numbers of golfers went down quite dramatically. I think they went from something like halved over the space of a decade. And Areti was always the smallest of the clubs, and it just fell prey to the fact that it just didn't have enough members. I mean, there were about 90 members in the end. So, that was a frustrating. I don't know anybody who went there that didn't think it was terrific. And especially the sort of connoisseurs of golf, if you like, that appreciate that raw links style golf. But the club just wasn't strong enough to be able to endure the sort of the fall off in play, and it's fallen by the wayside.
Well, there's a lot of golf courses around the country that are struggling now with membership falling, particularly in rural areas. Do you think there are too many golf courses in New Zealand? I mean, I think the number is somewhere around 400, and I have heard people in high places say one of the biggest problems New Zealand golf has got, there are too many golf courses.
Yeah, look, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? On the one hand, yes, clearly it's very difficult for clubs to survive given the given the number of members that they have now. You know, memberships have...
Well, the average age of golf club membership in New Zealand, I think, now is close to 60.
Yeah, so there's two trends that have been, you know, funnily enough, have been interrupted by COVID. There's been quite a jump in membership over the last 6 months, and a jump in playing numbers. But I think we should probably not presume that the general trend is not going to continue once the COVID mess is resolved, one form or another. Yeah, so memberships have been in general declining. Golf play hasn't been declining, so people are still, more and more people are playing golf. In fact, more rounds being played, but membership's in decline. And that, you know, people's relationship with the game is different today. The value proposition, if you like, that existed for golf when you and I were growing up was as much social, probably, as social networking as it was about the game. It was the place where Dad went on Saturday and played, and the clubhouse was full, and everybody was in having a drink afterwards, and Mum was at home looking after the kids, and I'm certainly not pining for that past, but I mean that isn't the way families are engaged today. A lot of families are double income families.
Which brings me to a point here, Greg. Gary Player said to me in an interview I did with him a year or two ago, and he's still actively involved in golf course design, but he said the most active area of his business is designing 12 hole golf courses in America. He said he can't keep up with the demand for new courses. People don't want 18-hole golf courses. If you want to play 18, well, you can easily do it off the back of 12 holes, of course. But it's better than just 9 holes because you're out on the course a little longer for at least 2 hours. Do you have any enthusiasm for 12-hole golf courses?
Yeah. I think in urban areas especially, where there's more pressure on land area, where there's more pressure on lifestyle and on time, Then being able to consume the game, if you like, in a shorter form is not a bad idea at all. We're not about to lose 18-hole golf, but certainly I think people's desire or ability to set aside 5 or 6 hours, and certainly the generations that are younger than us. is a lot less than it used to be. So I think we need to be open-minded about the fact that a shorter form of the game is not a bastardization of the game.
What about this idea, which you hear all the time and it's poo-pooed, is the look of golf courses in the future? They're all going to be 8,000 yards. And, of course, with the distance you can hit the ball and the distance the ball can travel, it's a scary thought. But are they going to dominate the golf architecture business in years to come, 8,000-yard courses?
I hope not. And I don't think they will, because I think that sooner or later the authorities will recognise they need to do something. I don't think it's generally a worry. I think people are too worried about it, more worried than they need to. For 99% of players, things haven't changed enough to warrant lengthening the golf course. It's only really for Ryan Fox and his mates. And how often do they come to play? So I think that's a problem for the game at the elite level. And I think the authorities need to be engaged with that, because I don't think the game is as interesting. I think it's much less multidimensional when it's played the way it's currently being played at the top level. And ultimately, that will have an impact on the popularity for people wanting to watch it, I believe. So they need to. But I think for your average course, I would not be concerned about that. I consulted a few places, as you say, and I quite often get asked to go out and I'll say, we think we need some more tees. We need, the course is too short. We need longer tees. And almost always I end up saying to them, look, I think your instinct is right. There's not enough distance from your back tees to your forward tees. But the problem is not that you need new back tees, you need more forward tees. Because that's where people ought to be playing more and increasing. That's where the beginners, that's where people as they get older should be moving forward.
It's
once in the blue moon when Ryan Fox comes to play, well, if it's a bit short for him, so what?
Said to me on this very show not so long ago that if you're a club golfer and you can't get to a par 4 and 2, you're playing the wrong tees.
Look, I think that's with all due respect, maybe a slight exaggeration, but in principle, it's not a bad thing way to look at it. Certainly, when we did the job at Royal Wellington, we were building five sets of tees there, and other than the black at the back, which we figured we didn't need to change that, they changed the colour coding for all of them. To try and get away from the idea that, you know, there's ladies' tees and there's men's tees. You know, the tees you play off, and as a designer, the tees I want you to play off are the ones that are there appropriate for how far you hit the ball and your skill set. And that's just as different amongst women as it is amongst men. And the idea that when you go out on Saturday, you all have to play off the same tee if you're in a men's competition, what a load of nonsense. You know, if you do that, people say, well, it's more social. Well, it's not more social, because if I play off the same tee as someone who hits the ball 140 metres, then I see them on the tee, then I don't see them again until the green, you know. Whereas if I play from the tees that are appropriate for me, they would do from there. They watch me hit, you move up to their tee, you go off down, and you're in a sort of a similar area after your tee shot. So it's not antisocial. And I think we need to get a head around that, because, you know, that gets in the way of people's enjoyment of the game.
I suppose a final thought here, Greg, if authorities are concerned about the length of some of these golf courses, the easiest way, as I suppose Jack Nicklaus has been saying for 40 years, is to get the USGA and the R&A to reduce the distance the golf ball will travel.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's hard because it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. I believe they have to accept the idea of, is it bifurcation? Is that the word they use?
Yeah.
Where there's a slightly different set of rules in the professional game. There is, you know, if you look at most sports, there's, you know, baseball, they don't use a metal bat, and it's not just a free for all where everybody, the game is a different game at the top level than it is for everybody. So, you know, I recall back, and you would too, that when the small ball and the big ball were both in operation, and there was a period there where playing with the big ball was much more difficult to play with. You know, it was still in its evolution, and as an amateur, you're allowed to play with the small ball, but you knew that if you wanted to compete with the best, that the big ball was the future. That's what you need to be doing. So it kind of, the top players migrated to that anyway, and I think they would do the same if there was a if there were constraints on the professional game. The leading amateurs would want to see how they compare with the professionals. They would play by the same rules and with the same equipment. You know, for the rest of people, then you know, give them the benefit of technology. The game's amply difficult enough. The technology doesn't solve the problems for most people.
For sure. I seem to recall my father used to tell me when I first started playing golf, if it's a windy day, use the small ball. If it's a calm day, use the big ball.
That's right.
Yeah,
I can recall.
Yeah, long time ago. Anyway, Greg, very enjoyable. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Very fascinating indeed listening to your thoughts on where the game is going, particularly from a golf architectural point of view. And we wish you well with all your programs. And once again, thanks for your time today. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Greg Turner, our guest today on the Tee, coming to you, of course, in association with JK's World of Golf and the Akarana Golf Club. We'll be back in 2 weeks, and hopefully we'll have my co-host Tom Hyde alongside of me as well. In the meantime, good golfing.
You've been listening to On the Tee, Golf New Zealand podcast, hosted by Tom Hyde and Brendan Telfer. Proudly presented by Podcasts New Zealand and Guerrilla Voice Media. You can find us online at podcasts.nz.